Hi. Tonight I'm going to be giving a reading. Afterwards, I'd be happy to talk to people outside in the common area or in the cafe. We're doomed. Pessimism is the night side of thought, a melodrama of the futility of the brain, a poetry written in the graveyard of philosophy. Pessimism is a lyrical failure of philosophical thinking, each attempt at clear and coherent thought, sullen and submerged in the hidden joy of its own futility. The closest pessimism comes to philosophical argument is the droll and laconic, "We'll never make it," or simply, "We're doomed." Every effort doomed to failure, every project doomed to incompletion, every life doomed to be unlived, every thought doomed to be unthought. Pessimism is the lowest form of philosophy, frequently disparaged and dismissed, merely the symptom of a bad attitude. No one ever needs pessimism in the way that one needs optimism to inspire one to great heights and to pick oneself up, in the way one needs constructive criticism, advice and feedback, inspirational books, or a pat on the back. No one needs pessimism, though I like to imagine the idea of pessimist self-help or pessimist activism. No one needs pessimism, and yet everyone, without exception, has at some point in their lives had to confront pessimism, if not as a philosophy, then as a grievance against oneself or others, against one's surroundings or one's life, against the state of things or the world in general. There's little redemption for pessimism and no consolation prize. Ultimately, pessimism is weary of everything and itself. Pessimism is the philosophical form of disenchantment. Disenchantment as chanting, as chant, as a mantra, as a solitary monophonic voice rendered insignificant by the intimate immensity surrounding it. In pessimism, the first axiom is a long, low, funereal sigh. We're still doomed. No one has time for pessimism. After all, there are so many hours in a day. Whatever our temperament, happy or sad, engaged or disengaged, we know pessimism when we hear it. The pessimist is usually understood as the complainer, forever pointing out what is wrong with the world without ever once offering a solution. But more often than not, pessimists are the quietest of philosophers. What little sound it makes is of interest to no one. I've heard it all before, tell me something I don't know, sound and fury signifying nothing. In raising problems without solutions, in posing questions without answers, in retreating to the hermetic, cavernous abode of complaint, pessimism is guilty of that most inexcusable of Occidental crimes, the crime of not pretending it's for real. Pessimism fails to live up to the most basic tenet of philosophy, the as if. Think as if it will be helpful, act as if it will make a difference, speak as if there is something to say, live as if you are not, in fact, being lived by some murmuring non-entity, both shadow and mud. Had it more self-assurance and better social skills, pessimism would turn its disenchantment into a politics or a religion, possibly calling itself the great refusal or the great no. But there's a negation in pessimism that refuses even such a refusal, an awareness that from the start it has already failed and that the culmination of all that is that all is for naught. Pessimism tries very hard to present itself in the low, sustained tones of a requiem mass or the tectonic rumbling of Tibetan chant. But it frequently lets loose dissonant, tinny tones at once plaintive and pathetic. Often its voice cracks, its weighty words abruptly reduced to mere shards of guttural sound. maybe it's not so bad after all. If we know pessimism when we hear it, this is because we've heard it all before, and we didn't need to hear it in the first place. Life is hard enough. What you need is a change of attitude, a new outlook, a shift in perspective, a cup of coffee. If we have no ears for pessimism, this is because it is always reducible to something as reliably mutable as a voice. If pessimism is so frequently disparaged, it is because it brings everybody down, determined as it is to view each day as a bad day, if only by virtue that it is not yet a bad day. For pessimism, the world is brimming with negative possibility, the collision of a bad mood with an impassive world. In fact, pessimism is the result of a confusion between the world and a statement about the world, a confusion that also prevents it from entering the hallowed halls of philosophy. If pessimism is so often dismissed, this is because it is often impossible to separate a bad mood from a philosophical proposition. And do not all philosophies stem from a bad mood? The very term pessimism suggests a school of thought, a movement, even a community. But pessimism always has a membership of one, maybe two. Ideally, of course, it would have a membership of none, with only a scribbled, illegible note left behind by someone long forgotten. But this seems unrealistic, though one can always hope. The anatomy of pessimism. Though it may locate itself at the margins of philosophy, pessimism is as much subject to philosophical analysis as any other form of thought. And pessimism's lyricism of failure gives it the structure of music. What time is to the music of sorrow, reason is to a philosophy of the worst. Pessimism's two major keys are moral and metaphysical pessimism. Its subjective and objective pulls, an attitude towards the world and a claim about the world. For moral pessimism, it is better not to have been born at all. For metaphysical pessimism, this is the worst of all possible worlds. For moral pessimism, the problem is the solipsism of human beings, the world made in our own image, a world for us. For metaphysical pessimism, the problem is the solipsism of the world, objected and projected as a world in itself. Both moral and metaphysical pessimism are compromised philosophically. Moral pessimism by its failure to locate the human within a larger context, and metaphysical pessimism by its failure to recognize the complicity in the very claim of realism. And so this is how pessimism makes its music of the worst, a generalized misanthropy without the anthropos. Pessimism crystallizes around this futility. It is its amor fati, rendered as musical form. The melancholy of anatomy. There's a logic of pessimism that is fundamental to its suspicion of philosophical system. Pessimism involves a statement about a condition. In pessimism, each statement boils down to an affirmation or negation, just as any condition boils down to the best or the worst. With Schopenhauer, that arch pessimist, the thinker for whom the philosopher and the curmudgeon perfectly overlap, we see a saying no to the worst, a no saying to the worst, a no saying that secretly covets a yes saying through asceticism, mysticism, quietism, even if this hidden yes saying is a horizon at the limits of comprehension. With Nietzsche comes the pronouncement of a Dionysian pessimism, a pessimism of strength or joy, a yes saying to the worst, a yes saying to this world as it is. And with Choran, yet another variation. futile yet lyrical, a no-saying to the worst, and a further no-saying to the possibility of any other world in here or out there. With Choron, one approaches but never reaches an absolute no-saying, a studied abandonment of pessimism itself. The logic of pessimism moves through three refusals: a no-saying to the worst, refusal of the world for us, or Schopenhauer's tears; a yes-saying to the worst, refusal of the world in itself, or Nietzsche's laughter; and a no-saying to both the for us and the in itself, a double refusal, or Choron's sleep. Crying, laughing, sleeping, what other responses are adequate to a life that seems so indifferent? Cosmic pessimism. Both moral and metaphysical pessimism point to another kind alongside it, a pessimism that is neither subjective nor objective, neither the for us nor the in itself, and instead a pessimism of the world without us. Maybe we could call this cosmic pessimism. But I don't know. It sounds too majestic, too full of wonder, too much the bitter aftertaste of the great beyond. Words falter, and so do ideas. And so we have a cosmic pessimism, a pessimism that is first and last a pessimism about cosmos, about the necessity and possibility of order. The contours of cosmic pessimism are a drastic scaling up or scaling down of the human point of view. The unhuman orientation of deep space and deep time, and all of this shadowed by an impasse, a primordial insignificance, the impossibility of ever adequately accounting for one's relationship to thought. All that remains of pessimism is the desiderata of affects, agonistic, impassive, defiant, reclusive, filled with sorrow, and flailing at that architectonic chess match called philosophy, a flailing that pessimism tries to raise to the level of an art form, though what usually results is something like slapstick. A song of futility. An ethics of futility pervades pessimism. Futility, however, is different from fatality and different again from simple failure, though failure is never simple. Failure is a breakage within the heart of relations, a fissure between cause and effect, a fissure hastily covered over by trying and trying again. With failure, there's always plenty of blame to go around. It's not my fault, it's a technical difficulty, it's a miscommunication. For the pessimist, failure is a question of when, if not. For the pessimist, failure is a question of when, not if. Failure as a metaphysical principle. Everything withers and passes into an obscurity blacker than night. Everything from the melodramatic decline of a person's life to the banal, flickering moments that constitute each day. Everything that is done, undone, everything said or known, destined for a kind of stellar oblivion. When scaled up in this way, failure becomes fatality. Fatality is the hermeticism of cause and effect. In fatality, everything you do, whatever you do, always leads to a certain end and ultimately to the end, though that end or the means to that end remains shrouded in obscurity. Nothing you do makes a difference because everything you do makes a difference. Hence, the effects of your actions are hidden from you, even as you deceive yourself into thinking that at last, this time, you will outwit the order of things. By having a goal, planning ahead, and thinking things through carefully, we attempt in a daily Prometheanism to turn fatality to our advantage, to gain a glimpse of an order that seems buried deeper and deeper in the fabric of the universe. But even fatality has its comforts. The chain of cause and effect may be hidden from us, but that's just because disorder is the order we don't yet see. It's just complex, distributed, and requires advanced mathematics. Fatality still clings to the sufficiency of everything that exists. When fatality relinquishes even this idea, it becomes futility. Futility arises out of the grim suspicion that behind the shroud of causality we drape over the world, there is only the indifference of what exists or what doesn't exist. Whatever you do ultimately leads to no end, an irrevocable chasm between thought and world. Futility tends to transform the act of thinking into a zero-sum game. A song of the worst. At the center of pessimism lies the term pessimus, the worst, a term as relative as it is absolute. The worst is about as bad as it gets, the worst as the best in disguise, shrouded by the passage of time or the twists and turns of fortune. For the pessimist, the worst is the propensity for suffering that gradually occludes each living moment, until it eclipses it entirely, overlapping perfectly in death, which for the pessimist is perhaps no longer the worst. Pessimism is marked by an unwillingness to move beyond the worst, something only partially attributable to a lack in motivation. In pessimism, the worst is the ground that gives way beneath every existent. Things could be worse, and things could be better. The worst invariably implies a value judgment, one made based on scant evidence and little experience. In this way, pessimism's greatest nemesis is its moral orientation. Pessimism's propositions have all the gravitas of a bad joke. And perhaps this is why the true optimists are the most severe pessimists. They're optimists that have run out of options. They're almost ecstatically inundated by the worst. Such an optimism is the only possible outcome of a prolonged period of suffering, physical or metaphysical, emotional or spiritual. But does this not also describe all the trials and tribulations of each day, in short, of living? It seems that sooner or later, we are all doomed to become optimists of this sort, the most depressing of thoughts. A song of doom. Rather than serving as a cause for despair, gloom and doom are the forms of consolation for any pessimist philosophy. Neither quite affects nor quite concepts, gloom and doom transform pessimism into a mortification of philosophy. Doom is not just the sense that all things will turn out badly, but that all things inevitably come to an end, irrespective of whether or not they really do come to an end. What emerges from doom is the sense of the unhuman as an attractor, a horizon towards which the human is fatally drawn. Doom is humanity given over to unhumanity in a crystalline act of self-abnegation. Gloom is not simply the anxiety that precedes doom. Gloom is literally atmospheric, climate as much as impression. And if people are gloomy, this is simply the byproduct of an anodyne atmosphere that only incidentally involves human beings. Gloom is more climatological than psychological, the stuff of dim, hazy, overcast skies, of ruins and overgrown tombs, of a misty, lethargic fog that moves with the same languorousness as our own crouched and sullen listening to a disinterested world. In a sense, gloom is the counterpoint to doom, and what futility is to the former, fatality is to the latter. Doom is marked by temporality, all things precariously drawn to their end. Whereas gloom is the austerity of stillness, all things sad, static, and suspended, a meandering smoke hovering cold lichen stones and damp fir trees. If doom is the terror of temporality and death, then gloom is the horror of a hovering stasis that is life. At times, I like to imagine that this realization alone is the thread that connects the charnel ground Aghori and the graveyard poets. Song of Spite. There's an intolerance in pessimism that knows no bounds. In pessimism, spite begins by fixing on a particular object of spite, someone one hardly knows or someone one knows too well, a spite for this person or a spite for all of humanity, a spectacular or a banal spite, a spite for a noisy neighbor, a yapping dog, a battalion of strollers, a meandering idiot walking in front of you on their smartphone, large, loud celebrations, traumatic injustices anywhere in the world regurgitated as media blitz, spite for the self-absorbed and overly performative people talking way too loud next to you at the table, technical difficulties and troubleshooting, the reduction of everything to branding, spite of the refusal to admit one's own errors, of self-help books, of people who seem to know absolutely everything and make sure to tell you, of all people, all living beings, all things, the world, the spiteful planet, the inanity of existence. Spite is the motor of pessimism because it is so egalitarian, so inclusive. It runs amok, stumbling across intuitions that can only half-heartedly be called philosophical. Spite lacks the confidence and the clarity of hatred, but it also lacks the almost cordial judgment of dislike. For the pessimist, the smallest detail can be an indication of a metaphysical futility so vast and funereal that it eclipses pessimism itself, a spite that pessimism carefully places beyond the horizon of intelligibility, like the experience of dusk, or like the phrase, "It is raining jewels and daggers." A Song of Sleep. A paraphrase of Schopenhauer. What death is for the organism, sleep is for the individual. Pessimists sleep not because they're depressed, but because for them sleep is a form of ascetic practice. Sleep is the askesis of pessimism. If, while sleeping, we have a bad dream, we abruptly wake up and suddenly the horrors of the night vanish. There is no reason to think that the same does not happen with the bad dream we call life. A Song of Sorrow. Nietzsche, commenting on pessimism, once castigated Schopenhauer for taking things too lightly. He writes, "Schopenhauer, though a pessimist, really played the flute. Every day, after dinner, one should read his biography on that. And incidentally, a pessimist, one who denies God and the world but comes to a stop before morality, who affirms morality and plays the flute, what, is that really a pessimist?" We know that Schopenhauer did possess a collection of instruments, and we know that Nietzsche himself composed music. There's no reason to think that either of them would have banished music from the Republic of Philosophy. But Nietzsche's jibes at Schopenhauer are as much about music as they are about pessimism. For the pessimist who says no to everything and yet finds comfort in music, the no saying of pessimism can only be a weak way of saying yes. The weightiest statement undercut by the flightiest of replies. The least that Schopenhauer could have done is to play the bass. I'm not a big fan of the flute, or for that matter, wind instruments generally. But what Nietzsche forgets is the role that the flute has historically played in Greek tragedy. In tragedy, the flute, aulos, is not an instrument of levity and joy, but of solitude and sorrow. The Greek aulos expresses not only the grief of tragic loss, but it does so in a way that renders weeping and singing inseparable from each other. The classicist Nicole Leroux calls this the mourning voice. Set apart from the more official civic rituals of funerary mourning, the mourning voice of Greek tragedy constantly threatens to dissolve song into wailing, music into moaning, and the voice into a primordial, disarticulate anti-music. The mourning voice delineates all the forms of suffering. Tears, weeping, sobbing, wailing, moaning, and the convulsions of thought reduced to an elemental unintelligibility. In the collapsed space between the voice that speaks and the voice that sings, pessimism discovers its own mourning voice. Pessimism, the failure of sound and sense, the disarticulation of phoné and logos. So have we rescued Schopenhauer from Nietzsche? Probably not. Perhaps Schopenhauer played the flute to remind himself of the real function of the mourning voice. Sorrow, sighs, and moaning rendered indistinguishable from music, the crumbling of the human into the unhuman, the highest failure of pessimism. Song of Nothing. In Buddhist thought, the first noble truth of existence is encapsulated in the Pali term dukkha, conventionally translated as suffering, sorrow, or misery. The Buddhist teachings are clear, however, that this is an objective claim, and that's not simply one point of view among others. Existence is suffering and sorrow. And yet this is not, the teachings tell us, a pessimistic attitude. It is likely that Schopenhauer, reading the Buddhist texts available to him, recognized some filiation with the concept of dukkha. But this term, dukkha, is a multifaceted term. There is certainly dukkha in the usual sense of the suffering, strife, and loss associated with living a life. But this is in turn dependent on the finitude and temporality of dukkha, existence as determined by impermanence and imperfection. And this ultimately points to the way in which both suffering and finitude are grounded by the paradoxical groundlessness of dukkha as a metaphysical principle, the insubstantiality or the emptiness of all that is. Beyond what is worst to me, beyond a world ordered for the worst, there is the emptiness of dukkha as an impersonal suffering, the tears of the cosmos. In this context, it is easy to see how Schopenhauer's pessimism attempts to compress all the aspects of dukkha into a nothingness at the core of existence, a willlessness coursing through the will. Although one thing for certain is that with Schopenhauer, we do not find the ever-smiling countenance of Buddhism. Or do we? The texts of the Pali Canon also contain lists of the different types of happiness, including the happiness of renunciation and the rather strange happiness of detachment. But Buddhism considers even the different types of happiness as part of dukkha in this final sense of nothingness or emptiness. Perhaps Schopenhauer understood Buddhism better than he's usually given credit for. thus the experiment of Schopenhauer's philosophy. The point at which a Western pessimist and an Eastern dukkha exchange glances. Empty sorrow, a lyricism of indifference. The result is a strange and ultimately untenable nocturnal form of Buddhism. Choran once called music a physics of tears. If this is true, then perhaps metaphysics is its commentary or its apology. Pessimism would be more mystical were it not for its defeatism. Mysticism is much too proactive for the pessimist, and pessimism too impassive even for the mystic. At the same time, there is something enviable about mysticism, despite or because of its sufferings. There's a sense in which pessimists are really failed mystics. You, the night, and the music. In a suggestive passage, Schopenhauer once noted that music is the melody to which the world is the text. Now, given Schopenhauer's view on life, that life is suffering, that human life is absurd, that the nothingness before my birth is equal to the nothingness after my death, given all of this, one wonders what kind of music Schopenhauer had in mind when he described music as the melody to which the world is the text. Was it opera, a requiem mass, a madrigal, or perhaps a drinking song, or something like Eine kleine Nachtmusik, a little night music for the twilight of thought, a sullen nocturne for the night side of logic, an era of sad wings sung by a solitary black-haired banshee. Perhaps the music Schopenhauer had in mind is music eliminated to non-music. A whisper would suffice. Perhaps a sigh of fatigue or resignation, perhaps a moan of despair or sorrow, perhaps a sound just articulate enough that it could be heard to dissipate. Teach me to laugh through tears. Pessimism always falls short of being philosophical. My back aches, my knees hurt, I couldn't sleep last night, I'm stressed out, and I think I'm finally coming down with something. Pessimism abjures all pretenses towards system, towards the purity of analysis and the dignity of critique. We didn't really think we could figure it out, did we? It was just passing time, taking a piss, something to do, a bold gesture put forth in all its fragility, according to rules that we have agreed to forget that we made up in the first place. Every thought marked by a shadowy incomprehension that precedes it and a futility that undermines it. That pessimism speaks, in whatever voice, is the singing testimony to this futility and this incomprehension. Take a chance and step outside, lose some sleep, and say you tried. Is there a music of pessimism? And would such a music be audible? The impact of music on a person frequently compels them to put their experience into words. When this fails, the result is a faltering of thought and language that is itself a kind of music. Choran writes, "Music is everything. God himself is nothing more than an acoustic hallucination." If a thinker like Schopenhauer has any redeeming qualities, it is that he identified the great lie of Western culture, the preference for existence over non-existence. As he notes, if we knocked on the graves and asked the dead whether they would like to rise again, they would shake their heads. In Western cultures, it is commonly accepted that one celebrates birth and mourns death. But there must be a mistake here. Wouldn't it make more sense to mourn birth and celebrate death? Strange, though, because the mourning of birth would, presumably, last the entirety of that person's life, so that mourning and living would become the same thing. To the musical idea of the harmony of the universe corresponds the philosophical principle of sufficient reason. Like the music of mourning, pessimism gives voice to the inevitable breakdown of word and song. And in this way, music is the overtone of thought. The patron saints of pessimism. The patron saints of pessimism watch over suffering. Laconic and sullen, the patron saints of pessimism never seem to do a good job at protecting, interceding, or advocating for those who suffer. Perhaps they need us more than we need them. Lest we forget, there do exist patron saints of philosophy, but their stories are not happy ones. There is, for instance, the 4th century Saint Catherine of Alexandria, or Catherine of the Wheel, named after the torture device used on her. A precocious 14-year-old scholar, Catherine was subject to continual persecution. After all forms of torture failed, including the breaking wheel, the emperor finally settled for her decapitation, a violent yet appropriate reminder of the protector of philosophers. There are also patron saints of music and musicians, but theirs too are sad stories. In the 2nd century, Saint Cecilia was also subject to persecution and torture. As she knelt to receive the blade that would separate her head from her body, she ardently sang a song to God. It took 3 attempts before she was fully decapitated, all the while she continued, perhaps miraculously, to sing. But does pessimism not deserve its own patron saints, even though they're unworthy of martyrdom? But in our search, even the most ardent naysayers frequently lapse into brief moments of enthusiasm. Pascal's love of solitude, Leopardi's love of poetry, Schopenhauer's love of music, Nietzsche's love of Schopenhauer, and so on. Should one then focus on individual works of pessimism? We could include Kierkegaard's trilogy of horror, Sickness Unto Death, The Concept of Dread, and Fear and Trembling, but all of these are undermined by their fabricated and unreliable authors. Besides, how can one separate the pessimist from the optimist in works like Unamuno's The Tragic Sense of Life, Shestov's Potestas Clavium, or Edgar Saltus's Under Red, The Philosophy of Disenchantment? Even in cases where the entire corpus of an author seems pessimistic, the project always seems incomplete. Witness Charan's trajectory from his first book, On the Heights of Despair, to the last unpublished notebooks of acrid and taut aphorisms. And of course, this is to say nothing of literary pessimism. From Goethe's Sorrow for Werther, to Dostoevsky's Underground Man, to Pessoa's Disquiet Scribbler, Baudelaire's Spleen and Ennui, the mystical Satanism of Huysmans and Strindberg, the hauntologies of Mario de Sacanero, Izumi Kiyoka, H.P. Lovecraft, and then there's grumpy old Beckett, even the great pessimist stand-up comedians. So all that remains are singular, perhaps anomalous statements of pessimism, a litany of quotes and citations crammed into fortune cookies. Patron saints are traditionally named after a locale, either a place of birth or of a mystical experience. Perhaps the better approach is to focus on the places where pessimists were forced to live out their pessimism. Schopenhauer facing an empty Berlin lecture hall, Nietzsche mute and convalescent at the home of his sister, Wittgenstein, the relinquished professor and solitary gardener, Choron, grappling with Alzheimer's in his tiny writing alcove in the Latin Quarter. There's a ghost that grows inside of me, damaged in the making. And there's a hunt sprung from necessity, elliptical and drowned. And where the moving quiet of our insomnia offers up each thought, there's a luminous field of gray inertia and obsidian dreams burnt all the way down. I close with a passage from Shestov's book, The Apotheosis of Groundlessness, a summary not just of pessimism as a philosophy, but of pessimism as voice. When a person is young, he writes because it seems to him he has discovered a new almighty truth which he must make haste to impart to forlorn humankind. Later, becoming more modest, he begins to doubt his truths, and then he tries to convince himself. A few more years go by, and he knows he was mistaken all around, so there's no need to convince himself. Nevertheless, he continues to write, because he is not fit for any other work, and to be accounted a superfluous person seems so horrible. Thanks. I guess we have time, right?
Let's think. We've got 15 minutes.
So. If you guys want. I mean, I'm happy to talk individually afterwards, maybe. But.
Let's leave
it there.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.